You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Frontline and the New York Times recently completed a nine-month-long investigation into the death of Michelle O'Connell. She was a 24-year-old woman who died from a gunshot the night she broke up with her boyfriend, Jeremy Banks, a deputy in the St. Johns County, Florida Sheriff's Department. Her death, which was labeled a suicide by local authorities, is the subject of a Frontline documentary called A Death in St. Augustine that explores how well law enforcement agencies police their own. It airs tonight at 10 p.m. on PBS. Walt Bogdanich, assistant editor at the New York Times Investigations Desk, headed the investigation. He's featured in the Frontline documentary, and I'm very pleased it has brought him to our show. Hello.
Hi.
Hasn't the Frontline piece just been completed at the last minute? Is that to coordinate with your long piece in the Times, or because the story has been so fluid?
Well, it's been fluid, but I think I'd like to think that it was because they have such a high standard that they wanted to work on it up to the very last minute, that just as we do at the Times.
Michelle O'Connell was shot with Deputy Sheriff Banks' service revolver. Was hearing that she was killed with his weapon what first got you interested in the case?
Actually, it was. When you hear that a deputy's service revolver, it wasn't a revolver, it's a semi-automatic handgun, factored in the killing, and that to follow up on that, the local police looked at their own and did the investigation rather than calling in somebody from the outside. Well, any curious reporter would want to know more, and I would put myself under that in that category.
Well, Jeremy Banks was the only other person who was at home when Michelle O'Connell died. What did he tell the dispatcher when he called 911?
Well, he said, you know, my girlfriend shot herself. There's blood everywhere. And when the dispatcher started, you know, trying to calm him down and mistakenly thought it was a woman, and he's saying, ma'am, you got to calm down. All of a sudden, he breaks in. And he said, it's sir. And to tell you the truth, I'm Deputy Banks. And, of course, that struck a number of us as a bit odd.
Yeah, well, hearing it on the film, it doesn't sound all that convincing. And not what I'd expect from a police officer at the scene of a killing.
Well, he, you know, in his defense, I mean, he was, he says he was emotionally distraught and quite panicky. So, you know, that's what he says. And I guess we have to take him at his word.
Well, you spoke with some of the officers who had responded to that 9/11 call. Did you get the feeling that they believed Deputy Banks' story automatically?
Well, we listened to a number of the interviews that were conducted later by state investigators with these deputies. And in those interviews, it became clear that a number of them did not quite, you know, figure out the crime scene, did not see it in quite the same way as Deputy Banks did. But their questions, apparently, and their suspicions or their concerns did not take root.
Did they question him on his version of the events?
Well, there was an interview. It was brief, the night of the shooting. It was about 2 hours later. He had basically roamed around without any minder, doing what he, you know, cared to do, shaking hands, having hugs with fellow deputies. So there was a brief, rather brief interview then, and then there was a longer one a bit later.
Well, one of the officers who'd been called to the scene of Michelle O'Connell's shooting, Deborah Maynard, told you that she smelled alcohol on Deputy Banks's breath that night. Another said he had told Banks to sober up. Didn't you learn over the course of your investigation that Banks had a reputation for losing control of his temper when he got drunk?
Well, that's what one of his former roommates said. He was quite clear in saying that he was concerned about his temper, particularly when he drank, and said so in an interview with state investigators.
And isn't alcohol a factor in many cases of domestic abuse?
It is. And he himself admits that he had had too much to drink and for that reason did not drive the car to the house just before the shooting. So he admitted he was boozed up, and just about everybody over there concurred because he really did reek of alcohol.
Most people who see this Frontline program or who read the article that ran on the front page of last Sunday's New York Times, will be convinced that Deputy Banks shot Michelle O'Connell because so much of the evidence points that way. And yet he's never been charged?
No, he's never been charged. And I want to make it clear that we did not set out to prove or disprove the allegation that Mr. Banks had a role in this thing. I mean, that wasn't our goal. Our goal was to look at the quality of the investigation that was done, look at the evidence, and try and see where it leads us.
Well, officers are automatically fired if they test positive for marijuana. But don't they usually retain their jobs after they've been accused of battering or abusing a spouse?
Actually, they do. And that was one of the more surprising aspects of our national look at this problem, is that you can have a tiny amount of marijuana in your system, and yet you can be, you know, battering and abusing your wife and keep your job. And both are crimes in most states, yet they're treated very differently.
Could you have done a similar investigation elsewhere? You've said that you were drawn to this case because Florida has a strong Open Records Act.
Well, it certainly made our investigation a lot easier because it was in Florida. And it does have the best Open Records Act, and that's how we were able to get so much documentation from the crime scene and all. But I should caution that an Open Records Act is only as good as the officials who carry it out, and we've had problems getting records that we are entitled to from the sheriff's office, and we've had to engage our own lawyers in trying to get those records.
So this is like a FOIA request. You can make the request and then hope that you're going to get something that isn't redacted get something at all.
Yes. I mean, there is a presumption in the state of Florida that you're going to get them because there is a tradition in that state of among public officials of turning over documents. And to some degree, you know, the sheriff's office did turn over documents initially when I guess they were trying to curry favor with me. And later when they saw the direction of where I was going and the kinds of questions I was asking, it became increasingly more difficult to get those records.
I'm talking with Walt Bogdanich, assistant editor at the New York Times Investigations Desk, and also one of the people involved in a Frontline documentary that will be airing tonight at 10 p.m. How did the investigative partnership between Frontline and the New York Times come about?
Well, I have an old friend who had brought me this idea, and we both thought that it would make good television. Now I work at the New York Times, but at one time in my life I was a producer for 60 Minutes. And so I thought, well, why don't we collaborate on this? Because it certainly had a powerful narrative to tell in words, and it certainly had the material to make a compelling documentary, so we joined forces.
There are a lot of red flags that go up, including the unorthodox way that Jeremy Banks was questioned. Wasn't he interviewed in a police car parked outside the house instead of being taken to the station house for a formal interview?
He was, and the protocol, according to the homicide and investigators that we talked to, is to isolate him, take him into a structured environment, photograph him, and do a serious interview. That really didn't happen this first time.
His commanding officer sat in on the interview. Is that unusual?
According to Commander Vernon Geberth, of the former head of homicide in New York City, he thought it was very unusual. He said, "I wouldn't do that." He didn't know anybody who would. And he said, there is no courtesy in a homicide investigation. And he pointed out, I'm not saying this was a... What he said was that all of these suspicious shootings have to be treated as a homicide until proven otherwise.
Well, one of the officers told you he had a gut feeling that Jeremy Banks' explanation didn't add up, but that he didn't investigate any further. Did he tell you why he didn't follow through on his suspicions?
Well, I think what we had concluded based on the totality of the documents and conversations that we've had was that there was a general movement, sort of a momentum that built that I guess people didn't want to stand in the way of. I mean, very early on, it was decided that this was going to be a suicide. And at that point, you know, the whole attitude of the investigators changes. I mean, they tend to ask fewer questions. I mean, one of the detectives said it's a CYA thing now, just to make sure we don't, you know, make a mistake. But basically, it was wrapped up by the end of the first night.
Because the top officers had already suggested that that's the way they wanted it to go?
Well, there were two relatively inexperienced detectives that were assigned to this very sensitive case. And that is one of the problems, because they didn't – between them, they had only investigated a total of three homicides. And they prematurely, by the sheriff's own admission, prematurely concluded that this was a suicide, and as a result did not do standard police work, which would be expected in a suspicious shooting like this one.
What – I mean, just the sorts of things they did at the crime scene?
Yeah. I mean, they didn't collect all the evidence. They didn't collect all the clothing. They did test for fingerprints and for DNA, but they never sent it in for analysis.
And Michelle's mother, her siblings, and her friends told you they were incredulous at the idea that Michelle had killed herself. Why were they so sure she hadn't committed suicide?
Well, let's start with the fact there was no suicide note, number one. Number two, Michelle O'Connell had just started a brand new job that she loved. And with full benefits, and this was something that she had wanted and desired for a long time.
She called it the job of her dreams.
Job of her dreams. And number three, she was breaking up with him that night. I mean, you might be able to understand suicide if, you know, you're heartbroken because your paramour is breaking up with you. But in this case, it was Michelle who was breaking up with the boyfriend.
And they said she was completely devoted to her 4-year-old daughter, Alexis, and that one of the perks of the job was that she could bring Alexis to work with her.
And that's exactly what made the job so appealing to her, apart from the fact that she just loved to be around children.
And then Michelle's mother, her siblings, and friends told you that they were never interviewed by the sheriff's department about her death, and that when they tried to provide information, including complaints Michelle had made to them about the rough treatment she had received from Jeremy Banks at home, it was dismissed as hearsay.
Isn't that amazing? You have a young woman who dies, who supposedly commits suicide, leaves no note, and you never bother to interview the family to find out what was going on in her life? Very strange.
The night she died, Michelle sent anxious text messages to her friends and family from a rock concert that she was attending with Jeremy Banks. What did she say in those text messages?
She was basically saying, you know, look out for my daughter. Make sure that she's okay, in so many words. And depending on where you sit in this controversy, you can interpret it different ways. The police interpreted that as a woman on the verge of suicide. The family interpreted it as somebody who was perhaps fearful of what would happen when she broke up that evening with her boyfriend.
My guest is Walt Bogdanich, assistant editor at the New York Times Investigations Desk. We're talking about the long article that appeared in the Sunday Times, this past Sunday Times, and also a documentary as part of the Frontline series on PBS that premieres tonight at 10 p.m. It's called A Death in St. Augustine. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Walt Bogdanich of the New York Times, also one of the people featured in the Frontline documentary called A Death in St. Augustine, which premieres tonight at 10 p.m. on Frontline series on PBS. I got the impression from the documentary that it would have been difficult to overestimate the power wielded by a man named David Shore, the elected sheriff of St. John's County, which includes St. Augustine. Is he still in office?
He's totally still in office and still wielding power and still having his way with just about everything that moves in that county, including the media.
Now, I got the feeling that he's not only the head of law enforcement in the area, but also the area's largest employer.
Well, actually not the largest employer, but one of the largest employers. And because there are no really big cities in that county, the sheriff's office is the pinnacle of local law enforcement.
And Michelle's relatives, some of them, also work for the sheriff's department. Her mother. Didn't one of her brothers, Scott O'Connell, even work as the sheriff's deputy alongside Jeremy Banks?
He did. And in fact, Michelle's brother, Scott, was the one who introduced Jeremy to Michelle.
So they must have been caught in a bind. On the one hand, they wanted the truth to come out. What they saw was the truth about Michelle's death. On the other hand, they probably didn't want to lose their jobs.
Well, I don't know what the sheriff was thinking or what their investigators were thinking. All we can do is judge them by their actions, and obviously they weren't as curious as I was.
And then more things happened. 2 days after the shooting, Dr. Frederick Hoban, the local medical examiner, performed an autopsy and ruled Michelle's death a suicide. Didn't the case lay dormant after that until a blogger in Washington State who writes about domestic violence cases involving police officers picked up the story?
That's correct.
That's the other side of the country.
Yeah.
About as far away as you can guess.
Sometimes it takes that. But one quick thing about Dr. Hoban's autopsy, and it's one of the facts that make this case so compelling, is the poor work done by the medical examiners. He reached this conclusion of suicide without ever looking at the weapon itself to find out where the, for instance, the ejection port was, where the shell would go after a shot. And he concluded that it was the shell that had caused this some injury to her face rather than some other perhaps physical altercation. But it was
which might have been the gun being held to her face and pressed against her face.
Well, or smacked with a gun, or who knows what. But there was a cut above her eye that was unexplained and later turned into perhaps the central forensic issue in this whole case.
It wasn't, we'll get to this later, but didn't somebody else also determine that the shooter had to be left-handed, which Jeremy Banks was? She was right-handed.
She was, and this was a crime reconstructionist that was hired by the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, which was eventually brought into the case because of an apparent conflict of interest and between the state attorney and the sheriff and the state attorney. So, you know, that was a factor.
So we have this blogger, and she calls attention. Actually, it's kind of interesting. She doesn't want her name used. She's identified only as Cloud Rider, which is the name she uses on her blog. But then she appeared on camera. Well, I suspect a lot of people who know her recognized her.
Yes. What struck her as unusual was she found a small she found a small article in the local St. Augustine paper that was largely devoid of facts. And it basically said an anonymous deputy and an anonymous girlfriend and an anonymous building. Somebody ended up dying, and anonymous investigators decided that nothing was done wrong. And she somehow thought that was merited a closer examination.
And that prompted the sheriff, who up until this point has just been so committed to the suicide theory, to ask for an independent inquiry?
Well, the blogger had this website called Behind the Blue Wall, and it served as a rallying point for Michelle O'Connell's family. And they used that, posting comments to people who were interested to call the sheriff, put pressure on the sheriff. And it was a factor, as we're led to believe, in the sheriff deciding, okay, well, maybe I ought to have an independent body come in here and look at this.
So the investigation was headed by Rusty Rogers, who's a 30-year veteran, and he first uncovered two women who lived near Jeremy Banks' home, happened to be outside, and said that they'd heard a woman screaming for help immediately before each of the two shots were fired that night.
Yes. That is why the sheriff that evening should have canvassed the neighborhood, but the sheriff did not canvass the neighborhood. And Rusty Rogers, within 2 weeks of taking over this responsibility of reinvestigating the case, found these two women.
And then Sheriff Shore described those witnesses as frequent marijuana smokers. So was he suggesting that they were hallucinating?
I don't know. Maybe when he smokes marijuana, he has a different reaction. That's a joke. I don't know what he thought, but he did accuse them of smoking marijuana and possibly of smoking it on the evening of the shooting. However, it turns out that was not true.
Rusty Rogers found all sorts of other interesting information. For example, although Deputy Banks had said that he didn't clean his gun after the shooting, there was no blood, none of his DNA on his revolver. You would think that it would be there even if she had committed suicide.
Well, you would think so. I wasn't there. I don't know what happened, but certainly it was the suspicion of the investigators from the state that there should have been DNA. In fact, Jeremy Banks himself later told internal affairs investigators that he was surprised his DNA wasn't on the handle of the gun.
And then we have Jeremy Findlay brought in to establish how the gun was fired. We've kind of talked about that. He also told you later that he'd felt pressured to slant his results so that they would favor suicide over homicide.
Yes, that's a curious thing to say, particularly because the sheriff has been accusing the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, Rusty Rogers, of coaching witnesses. But now we have an example of this crime reconstructionist who said that the other side was trying to pressure him into concluding it was a suicide.
And then what happened next is confusing. Jerry Findlay's report was turned over to a local state attorney who stepped aside several months later, citing a conflict of interest without bringing any charges or otherwise moving the case forward. What was the conflict of interest?
He was close to the sheriff, and I'm sure he was close to the sheriff on day one. Why he waited many, many months to decide that he had this conflict is a question that I really wanted to ask him and tried repeatedly to ask him. But like the sheriff, he chose not to talk to me.
And then they brought in a new medical examiner, a man I wouldn't want to have as a witness in any trial that I was involved with, Dr. Predrag Bulic.
Yes, yes, Mr. Bulic. He came up with the upside-down gun theory to explain this cut above her eye. There is a tactical light, a searchlight that is attached to the weapon, to the barrel of the gun. And he was saying that the tactical light caused that injury. And prosecutors interpreted that to mean that when the gun was fired, the gun, instead of recoiling, it went forward. Now, I wasn't very good in physics, I'll be the first one to admit, but you know, other people who are explained to me that this is absolutely ludicrous.
It would recoil whether it was upside down or right side up.
Yeah, I mean, it's a response, you know, and that's why they call it recoil. So,
well, why would any? Wouldn't it be very difficult to shoot yourself with a gun upside down?
Well, it's been done. There were issues as to how this the path of the bullet, the questions raised that it was a bit unusual for a suicide.
And then you interviewed Dr. Bulic on camera. He wasn't even able to pull the gun from its retention holster.
Well, yes, Michelle O'Connell had no background in weapons and no experience with this particular gun or the retention holster, which is designed to make it hard to pull out. In other words, for an unauthorized person to sneak up on an officer and take out the weapon. So she didn't know really how to take it out. She had no experience as far as we know. And we thought we'd try out Dr. Bulic to see how well he did taking it out. Didn't do so well, by the way.
My guest is New York Times investigative journalist Walt Bogdanich, who wrote a long article in the Sunday Times on the story that we are discussing. He is also featured in a documentary on PBS's Frontline series that will be premiering tonight at 10 p.m. called A Death in St. Augustine. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So the Times just allowed you to spend a lot of time working on one article?
Well, I'm in the investigative unit, and we believe that there are certain topics that are worth our time. In fact, a considerable amount of time. In this case, a very considerable amount of time. And that's one reason I work at the Times, because it recognizes that to do serious investigative work, you've got to, you know, put in the effort.
Well, the story continues. They brought in another man, Brad King.
Yes, a special prosecutor. And he came in and took a look and basically agreed. Well, he didn't agree. What he said is, look, there is not enough evidence to prosecute Mr. Banks and dismiss the case.
And then the Sheriff Shore praised that. He made no attempt to appear impartial.
Well, he isn't impartial is not a word I would use in describing Sheriff Shore. He certainly is a very passionate defender of Mr. Banks and of his own investigation, although he admits there were flaws. He finally admitted that after we came down there and started investigating. But he says that ultimately it didn't matter because they got it right.
And toward the end of the documentary, you've included a chilling scene that was shot during a law enforcement convention at a resort hotel, during which Sheriff Shore praised Jeremy Banks from the stage. He also praised Scott O'Donnell, Michelle's brother, who had rejoined the force.
He had. He is no longer welcome in the family. He rekindled his relationship with Mr. Banks. He had lost his job when he expressed outrage over Mr. King, the special prosecutor's decision not to go forward with it. He had this emotional outburst, and he was fired. And when Sheriff Shore learned that he felt, according to his wife, had been manipulated by Mr. Rogers, he decided to, hear him out and hire him back, which he did.
Do you think that you're going to be hearing about other similar cases now that this one has been published?
Oh, my. I already have. if the Times would give me some assistance to try and process all this, it would be helpful. But I suspect they want me to move on.
Well, you also are an adjunct professor at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. I'd imagine you could enlist a few of your students to get involved in some project.
I have indeed in the past, and there are a lot of bright young people who are looking for a chance to, dig into a story like this or similar.
And as the winner of 3 Pulitzer Prizes, I assume that you're wondering whether a fourth one is going to come along for this one.
Well, no. I don't suspect they're going to give me another one. And whether I deserve it or not, I don't know. But, that was obviously not the reason I did the story. And it's never the reason you do these stories. It's nice when something good like that happens at the end. But it's also nicer when people understand what you're trying to do and react to it.
Also, it's interesting that we have this documentary to go along with a very long story that you've published in the New York Times. The two do seem to work well together.
They do, and it seemed to be the ideal story. And I very much enjoyed working with Frontline. It's something that I'd wanted to do for a very long time. They do such high-quality work, and like the Times, they dig into a subject. And it was just an incredible pleasure working with them.
And even though your ex-employer, 60 Minutes, does long-form journalism, long-form on 60 Minutes usually means about 14 minutes before the commercials for some drug that may be dangerous to my health comes on. So you get a full hour with Frontline.
I do. It was. I loved working for 60 Minutes. It was great experience, but the length was frustrating, and the structure of those stories is different because of the length.
And then there's one other thing. Now the New York Times, like WNYC and many other organizations, is giving us all sorts of visual stuff as well. The Times has incorporated some of the documentary into a multimedia story on its website.
They have, and that was, again, another reason I found this story so compelling and one of the reasons I wanted to do it. We have these very talented multimedia people who know things that I will never know about how to add the bells and whistles to make a long narrative piece readable.
The story we're talking about, put together by Frontline and the New York Times, was a nine-month-long investigation into the death of Michelle O'Connell. You can see the Frontline documentary tonight at 10 on Channel 13. It's called A Death in St. Augustine. My great thanks to Walt Bogdanich, assistant editor of the New York Times Investigations Desk, for being on our show today.
A pleasure being here. Thank you.